Now let's start with Netflix, one of the world's largest media companies, over 150 million subscribers worldwide. There was a time, though, back in the late 1990s, when it was all about renting DVDs through the post. It's fair to say that Netflix has come a long way from those humble beginnings, as has its co-founder, Mark Randolph, who was also its first CEO. He's just written a memoir called That'll Never Work. It focuses on Netflix's early days and the rise of one of the 21st century's most disruptive startups. Mark Randolph is with us. Good morning, Mark.
Good morning. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Well, thank you so very much for talking to us today. I guess, tell us about the idea. Where did Netflix come from? Where was the idea born?
Well, it's a gripping yarn. In fact, many of the reasons that I wrote That Will Never Work is because I wanted to share with people that kind of untold story of Netflix. Because as you mentioned earlier in the intro, you know, we have not always been this global streaming company, and we certainly have not always had 150 million subscribers. The whole thing started, if there was a moment, was when my co-founder and I, Reed Hastings and I, were both about to be out of a job when we sold the company we were working at. And we were casting about for what next. And all I knew at that time was I was ready to start another company, because Netflix, in fact, was number six. And Reed was going to go and change the world of education and go back to school. But we needed an idea. And the way we looked for that idea was we did it on a carpool. Driving back and forth to work, we brainstormed ideas. And we had a bunch of ideas I thought were actually pretty good.
What were your favorite ones? Because you outlined quite a lot of the ideas. And, there's dog food and the shampoo and there's all sorts. But which were the ones did you think, I think actually we're onto something here with one of these?
Well, I'm going to tell you that customized, personalized shampoo subscription I thought was pretty compelling. And the best evidence I can give of how compelling it was is that 20 years later, 20 years after we decided that was a stupid idea and tossed it out the window while we were commuting, I actually tried it again. I said, this has got to be the time. So, you know, some of these ideas, maybe their time isn't right, but they can't be let go of. But of course, one of the other crazy ideas, equally crazy, if not more so, was video rental by mail. Because this was back in 1997. And back then, people were just starting to think about selling things on the internet. Amazon at that point only sold books, if you can imagine a time like that. And we thought, what's a big category that we can go after? And video rental was it. But unfortunately, back then, video rental was done with VHS cassettes, if you remember those.
They're pretty heavy.
Yeah, and expensive and fragile. And so that was one more idea we researched and figured out it's never going to work. But our lucky break came about maybe 6-7 weeks later when we read about this new technology called the DVD. You know, it's a movie on this disc that was thin and light. And that gave Reed and I this new idea that maybe this was the chance to dust off that old video by rental idea that we'd thought about before. And so we did the thing that smart entrepreneurs do, is not think about it, not write a business plan, not do a pitch deck. We said, let's figure out right now whether at least the fundamental premise is valid. So we turned the car around and drove back down to the town we lived, and we couldn't buy an actual DVD. So we said, well, hopefully a CD is close enough, and bought a used music CD and then bought a little gift envelope, like you put a greeting card in, addressed it to Reed's house in Santa Cruz where we lived, bought a stamp and dropped the CD in an envelope into the slot at the mail at the post office. And 24 hours later, Reed at his house had an unbroken CD that he'd gotten in less than 24 hours for the price of a postage stamp. And that was enough. That crazy beginning was enough to say, let's give this a shot. You know, Reed wrote us a check for $1.9 million, and I hired a dozen people, rented a dingy little office, and we built the website, and off we went.
And what happened when you got to launch day?
Well, this was a different time. And back then, if you wanted to do a website, you couldn't just go up onto the cloud and get a Squarespace account, or if you wanted to take payments, get PayPal or Stripe, or you had to build everything yourself. You had to build your own website software. You had to install your own servers and wire them yourself. And so this simple little e-commerce test took us 6 months. And so, of course, this is April. Now it's April 1998. Been working for 6 months on getting this thing off the ground. And we were just worried, is it actually going to work? And we had rigged it up, actually, so that a bell would ring if an order came in. And we all turned it on at about 8 o'clock in the morning and all stood around expectantly. And it didn't take too long. And then finally, ding, that first order, which cheers all around, of course. And then a few minutes later, ding, ding, ding. And then we got up to, I think, 7 orders. And we were still excited and we were clapping each other on the back. And then someone noticed that it had been a while, you know, since the bell had rung last. And it turns out that 15 minutes in, we had crashed both of our servers. And so my memories of the day were not like toasting my success. My memories of the day was pushing the shopping cart up and down the aisles of an electronics store, piling in all the components we'd used to limp our servers along that day.
Because the servers had gone down, the whole thing crashed on the first day.
Exactly, the first 15 minutes. And we'd bring them up again, and then boom, crash again. And we go, okay, well, we should double the number and bring in 4 servers, and boom, crash again. It was extremely disheartening to think that this, on one hand, we were saying, wow, people actually want this. So that was encouraging. The discouraging thing, of course, was we couldn't, for the life of us, figure out how to keep a site open more than 20 minutes in a row.
Now, what about, I guess, the name Netflix? Talk us through how you decided on that as the company name.
So naming companies is surprisingly tricky because you can start out by saying, wouldn't this make a great name? But then you find out, well, that domain name is taken. Or you dig a little bit deeper and you say, oh, the domain name's available, but someone else has trademarked it. And especially even today, you know, the Twitter account's taken, as is Facebook, and it gets very hard. And in fact, it's so hard that one of the best pieces of advice I got was from an old mentor of mine who said that when you pick your beta name, it's called, the name you use while you're starting, before you do your real name, they go, pick one that is so bad that when you begin struggling to find your real name, you're not tempted to use your beta name. And just as a piece of trivia, our beta name was Kibble, like the dog food, which I thought was bad enough that we'd never be tempted to use it. But of course we were. But it all came down, we have to make a decision. And we had a list of the available names. And they were pretty bad. I mean, one was Replay. That was my favorite. One was Take Two. One was Cinema Center. And we had Netflix, but people didn't like it. Because I don't know if you recall these days, but back in 1998, a pornographic film was sometimes called a skin flick or plural skin flicks. And then, of course, Netflix had that big X at the end. But we all sat in a room and said, we've got to decide. And eventually we decided that, you know, Netflix does sound a little porny, but well, let's go with it.
So in terms of choosing that name, was it ever Netflix with the CKS at the end, or did it always have the X?
No, we actually went and locked up CKS, but it certainly worked graphically better. It was catchier. And this was just the beginning of that internet era where your names had to be a little catchy to try and make it a little edgy, to make it sound like you were a web company. I mean, now domains are so hard that, you know, it basically company names are any combination of 7 letters you can come up with. But we thought Netflix was just the right amount of edge. You know, and I think it's a pretty good, you know, it's grown on me. And certainly, it's, you know, people saying, let's Cinema Center and chill. It doesn't quite have the same ring.
It doesn't, but I guess the company has completely changed from shipping commodities, DVDs, out to people to being a content creator. But did you always have a sense that you were founding a company that was going to evolve in such an enormous way? Did you always know that DVDs were going to be here for, I guess, a fleeting time?
Well, you know, I called the book That Will Never Work for a reason. And it's because every single person that I pitched that idea to, every investor, all the employees, my wife said, that'll never work. And everyone who thought it would never work had the same two reasons. Reason number one was Blockbuster. There was 9,000 Blockbuster stores. You know, in the United States, pretty much everyone in the country could have thrown a rock and hit a Blockbuster store. But the second reason was people believed that DVDs were short-lived. And more specifically, that because DVD was a digital medium, it was just a matter of weeks before everybody was downloading or streaming movies. And the ironic thing is, you know, they were right that yes, it was digital and yes, they would download them, but we just thought it would take a lot longer. And so the challenge was, how do you build a company which will survive and thrive and build brand equity while you're still a DVD company? And then when the world transitions, you'll leverage all that position to be successful in streaming. So if we had made it the world's fastest shipper of plastic, it would have been great for DVDs, but wouldn't have worked in the streaming. But if we had said we're the best way to stream entertainment, it wouldn't have worked in the DVD world. And so instead we went delivery agnostic and said it's the best place to find movies you love. Because that worked now, it works in the future, it'll work forever. But so we knew it was coming. We just had to prepare ourselves for that eventuality.
And so in the meantime, you did have conversations with both Amazon and also Blockbuster about how you potentially could work together or perhaps not. How did those go?
Well, they had similar outcomes, but they were started from very different places. The call from Amazon took place in our first summer in business. We were probably only 3 months after launch. And that's when Jeff Bezos, the founder and CEO of Amazon, called and said, why don't you guys come on up to Seattle for a chat? And he was only selling books, but he'd made no secret of the fact eventually he wanted to sell videos, music, everything. And so we knew what that was. And it was very flattering because remember, this is an idea that everybody said that will never work. And here was the pioneer of e-commerce suggesting that we had some value. But at the other hand, he ended up, kind of hinting what the price would be. And it probably would have been maybe $14 to $16 million, which would have been a pretty good return for a year's work. But at the same time, we had just launched. We were just getting started. We'd gotten our website to work. And we weren't quite ready to hand over the keys. The Blockbuster story was a different one. This was a weird situation, which we had finally gotten the business to work, and it was taking off. We had this new model, and customers were flooding in. But because we were, at that point, a subscription business, we lost money for the first 2 or 3 months at every subscription. So the more people who came in, the faster we lost money. And this was 2000, right at the very bottom of the dot-com bust. And we were going to go out of business. And we decided to be the prudent entrepreneurs and try and sell the company. And the obvious person was Blockbuster. But when we finally flew to Blockbuster and pitched them on selling them Netflix and running it as a combined company, they were intrigued at first until they asked us how much we wanted for it. And when we explained $50 million, they basically laughed at us. And so... the outcomes were the same in that we were on our own, in one case by choice and in the second case by necessity.
What do you think would have happened if Blockbuster had said yes?
Oh, wouldn't that make a great movie where you could use different option channels in your DVD to pick different outcomes? I suspect that the forces that ultimately brought down Blockbuster, because of course they went from 9,000 stores back down to one, but I suspect the same forces that brought down Blockbuster were not solely Netflix. That even had they had Netflix, I question whether they could have survived the transition in the video business. I question whether we would have stuck around or would have been uncomfortable. They would have perhaps postponed things because they would have removed that thorn in their side. But I really question whether that would have made the difference.
Now, of course, everyone now thinks of Netflix as being a content creator and a streaming service. But curiously, that origin almost goes right back to near the beginning with the Clinton DVD. What was that all about?
Oh, you're really bringing up the great stories here. All the Mark Randolph's biggest screw-ups. No, that the challenge we had on day one was that we were trying to launch a company which was focused on DVD owners at a time when there weren't any DVD owners, or they were few and far between. We were looking for any way we could to get attention. And we were looking for some kind of big splash we could make. And we thought, wow, maybe we could make a DVD, make our own content. And just then, we found out that President Bill Clinton, who had been accused of, let's say, bad behavior in the White House, and had recently been forced to testify in front of a grand jury, we found out that that testimony was being made public. And it was going to be broadcast on all the major United States channels. We said, this is perfect. We'll go make a DVD out of the testimony, and made a big fuss out of it. We said we're going to launch it for 2 cents a copy. And orders began flooding in. But no one had ever really made a DVD that quickly before. We tried to go from content to final product in just a matter of days. And wow, it was much harder than we expected. And as a startup would do, we began cutting corners. And one of the corners, besides pushing production, was foregoing the labeling step, where you put the label on the DVD. And so we shipped them all out. People were loving it. We had gotten all this attention. We had done about 5,000 new customers that way. And then a few days later, we began getting these strange cryptic emails that made it sound like we had shipped people something pornographic. And of course, at first we thought this was just, that's just the Bill Clinton testimony and what he's talking about. And then we realized, oh no, this was actually very pornographic. And I went back to the warehouse and said, see if you can figure out what this is, and popped a copy into my own DVD player. And yes, it was absolutely that in our haste, we had shipped out about 100 copies out of the 5,000. That were by mistake, this Asian pornography. And of course, we were horrified. And I sent the email out to every single person, said, I'm sorry. And if you got this DVD by accident, please return it. And we'll instantly replace it with the correct disc. But it was kind of curious because, you know, no one did.
Huh. Now, let's talk a little bit about Reed Hastings, who you founded the company with. How would you describe Reed? Because I guess you've had some real highs, and then you've had some pretty difficult conversations.
You know, Reed and I were kind of the perfect partnership because we both came at the world from different places. I had spent my career as a marketing person. I was empathetic. I was creative. I was an idea guy. And Reed was a mathematician and computer scientist. He was logical. He was analytical. He was very disciplined. And combining those two things turned out to be extremely powerful. But more importantly, Reed and I shared this tremendous sense that we both needed to be honest with each other and with everybody, that life was too short to blur edges out of fear of not wanting to offend somebody. But it allowed us, when we were brainstorming ideas, for example, in that first car rides where we had all these crazy ideas, it allowed us to argue like crazy, back and forth, what's right, what's wrong, logically, you know, creatively, and then come to these mutual understandings and almost instantly switch into not remembering anymore whose idea it might have been, who had dug in that it was right or wrong, but we now knew the right path to go forward. And it was a great, great partnership, which I think is a lot of the reasons that made the company so successful. But, you know, sometimes this radical honesty, as we called it, can cut against you. And the one moment I believe you might have been alluding to is one of the difficult times is I was in my office. This was a bit more than a year in. And it was probably 6 or 7 p.m. and the door cracks open and Reed pops his head in and then delivers, you know, that words that we've all heard every now and then, which is, you know, Mark, we've got to talk. And as we all know, that usually doesn't signal something great. And in this case, Reed was quite concerned about my leadership, about my judgment, about my ability to navigate effectively as the company got bigger and the problems got larger and came upon us more quickly. And at first I thought he was trying to push me out because he had more stock than I did because he was the biggest investor. But what I realized ultimately was that Reed was actually saying something different. He was saying that not that I should leave, but that we should run the company together because he was not at the company at all full time. And he was saying he should join full time. He should be CEO. I move over and become president and we do it together. And because of this honesty, I knew there wasn't an ulterior motive. There was no axe to grind. This wasn't a power grab. Reed genuinely thought our chances were improved together. And I had to admit, he had a very good point. But it was tricky because I had had this dream of launching and running my own company and making it successful. But I realized that it was really two different dreams. And that even more importantly, the dream of being successful wasn't just my dream anymore, that it was my employee's dream and my investor's dream. And that I had to make that call, which is, was I willing to do anything I could to make the company work, even if it meant that I had to walk away from the idea of me being the sole person to bring us there.
Hmm. It has become phenomenally successful, 158 million subscribers, almost every country in the world. Are you still surprised? Are you proud of where Netflix has got to?
I am astounded with where it's gotten to. I seriously never in a million years imagined that we would have the scale and reach that Netflix has now, that we would have in almost every country in the world, that we would make our own movies, that produce our own television shows. It does astound me. And yeah, I'm certainly proud, but you know, I left the company 15 years ago. So I'm proud of the company the way that you might be proud of your children, where you love what they've accomplished, but you sometimes wonder to what degree was I responsible? How much of this is DNA? How much of it is active intervention? And it's funny, I think it's a combination of both. And I think a lot of people who wonder, will Netflix continue to thrive or survive? Or how will they do in the streaming wars?
Yeah, because it's becoming an ever more crowded marketplace, isn't it? And are consumers becoming overwhelmed with the choice, not just from one company like Netflix, but the possibility of having multiple streaming services?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I'm not absolutely about being confused, but absolutely about having choices. But I think it's a fantastic thing. I mean, as a consumer, what a wonderful time to watch television, to have all these amazing shows, you know, coming from, I mean, I'm not familiar with exactly the streaming leader is in New Zealand, but, you know, certainly in the United States with the new entry from, you know, Disney and from Apple and the existing products from Amazon and Hulu, it is tremendous. But I really believe that this is not a situation where you pick one. These prices are at a point where we can have multiple choices to choose from. And again, I think the reason that I wrote this book was so people understood, what is Netflix? What was the culture? What are the things that are part of this DNA so that they can understand why, not only why Netflix has been successful in the past, but why I think it'll continue to be so in the future.
And I guess it's one of the great disruptors of media. How do we see disruption now? Is it some kind of golden age of disruption? Is it always going to be with us, do you think?
Absolutely. It's accelerating. I mean, the pace at which abilities change is increasing. So there's always new ways to do things. And because of the fact, we'll just take an example that it took at Netflix 20 years ago, it took us 6 months to launch a simple website. So the distance from idea to validation was 6 months. Now, the distance from idea to validation can be as short as 6 hours. And that just allows you to try so many more things. At the same time, the problems that are facing the entrenched leaders is the same, which is that they don't want to change. They like the way the world is. They don't want to cannibalize their past in their future. So they're still lumbering. They're still vulnerable. I think it's a great, great time to be an entrepreneur. It's perhaps a bit less great if you're the person running the big $6 billion blockbuster-like company.
Also, though, I guess there's the other side to disruption where you see perhaps the likes of Uber and you see a lowering of pay and condition for the drivers, the people kind of right on the front line of the company. So is disruption always a good thing?
It's not always a good thing for every single person. And I agree that a lot of people would prefer that the world stay the way it does. Look at Blockbuster, which had 60,000 employees. I feel terrible that I played some small part in people losing their jobs. But at the same time, I'm tremendously excited about the opportunities that a company like Netflix has created in content creation. At Netflix, at other companies that are doing the same sort of things. There's always going to be bad actors, and you look at companies that are behaving poorly, but there's also companies who are doing tremendous good for the world by introducing new ways to do things. I'm excited. I think on the balance, I like where we're all headed.
You've talked about having, you know, a good idea, the good idea. I guess there's an amount of luck that goes into that. And looking back over your career of being an entrepreneur for, what, 4 decades, what do you think is the most important thing you've learned?
The most important thing is there's no such thing as a good idea. Ideas don't count. I've never met a successful company who became successful doing the thing they started doing. I've realized that what's important is the problem and that the ideas are temporary. So what you learn is as soon as you have an idea, your job is to figure out the quickest, easiest, cheapest way to quickly figure out if it's a good idea or a bad idea. That the longer you leave it in your head, the more time you spend writing a business plan, the more time you spend thinking about it, that's wasted. Get out, start, figure it out, try something.
So would that be your kind of number one rule for success?
Absolutely. It's stop thinking and start doing. That when I look at the people who are successful that I want to work with as a mentor, who I want to invest in as an angel investor, I'm looking at the people who have a predisposition to action, who recognize an idea is nothing until it's been tried.
Mark Randolph, thank you very much for your time this morning on RNZ National on 9 to Noon. The first CEO of Netflix, he's just written a book called That'll Never Work. Thank you very much for joining us.